and saw. During one of his first visits to a launch complex, the PTS team was doing a recycle, removing oxidizer from the missile. An enormous propane tank, known as a burn bot, sat near the silo door topside, burning excess propellant as it vented, roaring like a jet engine and shooting out a gust of flame. This sort of controlled burn was routine, like the flares at an oil field. Then the burn bot went out. The oxidizer leaked. A dirty orange cloud floated over the complex. And the sergeant beside Kennedy said, "You know that bullshit right there? You get that shit on your skin, it'll turn to nitric acid." Kennedy thought, "Wow," and watched with some concern as the cloud drifted over the control trailer and the rest of the PTS team continued to work, hardly noticing it. He felt like running for the hills. Clearly the textbooks at Chanute didn't tell you what really happened in the field. Kennedy soon realized there was the way you were supposed to do things, and the way things got done. Refco suits were hot and cumbersome, a real pain in the ass to wear, and if a maintenance task could be accomplished quickly and without an officer noticing, sometimes the suits weren't worn. The PTS team would enter the blast block, stash their Refcos against a blast door, and enter the silo unprotected. The risk seemed less important than avoiding the hassle. While disconnecting a vent hose in the silo, Kennedy once forgot to close a valve, inhaled some oxidizer, and coughed up nasty stuff for a week. On another occasion, oxidizer burned the skin off the top of his left hand. Working without a Refco violated a wide range of technical orders. But it forced you to think about the fuel and the oxidizer and the fine line between saving some time and doing something incredibly stupid. Within a few years, Kennedy had become a PTS team chief. He loved the job and the responsibility that it brought, and he loved the Air Force. Where else could a 25-year-old kid without a college degree be put in charge of complicated, hazardous, essential operations at a missile site worth hundreds of millions of dollars? The fact that a nuclear warhead was involved made the work seem even cooler. Over time, Kennedy had gained an appreciation for the Titan II, regarding it as a thing of beauty, temperamental but awe-inspiring. He thought you had to treat the missile with respect, like you would a lady. Keeping the Titan IIs fueled and ready to go, ensuring the safety of his men. Those were his priorities, and he enjoyed getting the work done. The recycles were one of Kennedy's favorite parts of the job. They took weeks to prepare. The weather had to be just right, with at least 3 knots of wind and the outdoor temperature rising, so that a leak wouldn't linger over the complex. Once the valves were turned and the fuel or the oxidizer started to flow, the team chief was in charge of the operation and the adrenaline kicked in. The danger was greatest when propellants were being loaded and offloaded. That's when something bad was most likely to happen, something unexpected and potentially catastrophic. It always felt good to finish a recycle, pack up the tools, load up the trucks, and send the PTS team home to Little Rock at the end of a long day. Some of the missile combat crew commanders were a pleasure to work with, Kennedy thought, and some of them were real pricks, officers who liked to meddle with things they didn't know anything about. The launch control center and the silo were only a few hundred feet apart, but the distance between the men who worked in them often felt like miles. Once, while Kennedy was learning the ropes, his team chief was criticized by a missile crew commander over the radio for skipping a few lines in a technical order. "Commander, if you want to tell me how to do my job," the team chief replied, "then you get your ass off your chair and you come and sit your ass in my chair." Kennedy soon adopted a similar way of dealing with combat crew officers, most of whom seemed afraid of the propellants. "Just leave me alone. The work will get done the right way, and then I'll get the hell off your launch complex." Most of all, Kennedy valued the intense loyalty among the PTS crews, a bond strengthened by the stress and the dangers of the job. They looked out for each other. At the end of a late-night shift, Kennedy's team members would sometimes flip a coin to see who'd babysit his kids. And then Kennedy's wife would dress in fatigues and sneak onto the base to join everybody for midnight chow in the cafeteria. The PTS crews didn't like it when someone couldn't take a joke. They didn't like it when someone couldn't work well with others. And they found all kinds of unofficial ways to impose discipline. At one missile complex, a PTS team waited until an airman with a bad attitude put on his refco. Then they grabbed him, stuck a hose down the neck of his suit, filled the suit with cold water, and left him lying on the ground, shouting for help, unable to stand up or take the refco off, rolling around and looking like a gigantic water balloon. He got the message. For the past year, Kennedy had served as a quality control evaluator, a job that required him to visit all the launch complexes and make sure that the work was being done properly. He'd been out to 4-7 many times. As the helicopter approached it, the command post radioed the latest pressure levels. The Stage 1 oxidizer tank had climbed to 23.4 psi, and the Stage 1 fuel had fallen to minus 0.7. The fuel reading unnerved Kennedy. The negative pressure meant a vacuum was forming inside the tank that supported the rest of the missile. The Stage 1 fuel tank was like a tin can with the air getting sucked out of it, and a 10-pound can sitting on top of it. First, the tank would crumple, then it would collapse. Word that the missile crew had just evacuated the control center pissed him off. That was chicken shit, Kennedy thought. That would make everything a lot more difficult. They would have been safe and sound behind those blast doors. The chopper pilot circled the complex, shining a spotlight toward the ground. Amid the darkness, Kennedy could see a thick white cloud rising from the exhaust vents. He told Colonel Morris that the cloud looked like fuel vapor, not smoke. It was a fuel leak, Kennedy thought, not a fire. And that meant maybe, just maybe, they could find a way to fix it. Around the same time that Kennedy got a call from Job Control, Jim Sandaker got one too. Sandaker was a 21-year-old PTS technician with a wife and a baby daughter, and the call reached him at home on the base. Job Control said there was a fuel leak at 4-7 and asked him to round up a bunch of other PTS guys to head out there. Sandaker hung up, told his wife, "Well, I gotta go," put on his uniform, and went to the barracks. He was good-natured and well-liked, low-key and solid, a country boy from